You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello, LawPod listeners out there. As often with fast-moving legal news, things have changed since this episode was recorded. On the 10th of May, the government announced a fundamental change to the retained EU law bill. As you'll hear, we discussed the so-called sunsetting clauses in the bill, which would have repealed all EU legislation at the end of the year, with the exception of any EU law that ministers decided to keep. Business Secretary Kimmy Badenoch has now announced that the government is to publish a list of the retained laws that will be scrapped by the end of 2023. Instead of thousands of unspecified EU laws expiring by the end of the year, a mere 600 out of the 5,000 odd pieces of legislation from the EU era will be repealed. The retained EU Law Revocation and Reform Bill has reached the report stage in the House of Lords. Its operation is to drain away vast swathes of law from the reservoir created around European Union law by the previous European Union Withdrawal Act of 2018. People are saying, to mix metaphors, ministers are given a cliff-edge power to throw EU law over the edge by the end of 2023. I have with me Sam Willis from the Public Law Project to discuss the subject. He's behind the PLP's briefing on the bill before the House of Lords. Sam, thank you very much for coming along and talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sam, this bill pursues the perfectly legitimate object of ensuring that UK legislation reflects the legal and political reality of our withdrawal from the European Union. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think the correct place to start really is to explain what retained EU law actually is. And then from there, we can begin to discuss the idea that you just put forward. The idea behind the European Union Withdrawal Act, which you just mentioned, and I'll call EUWA for short, because it's something of a mouthful, was to create a snapshot of the acquis of EU law as it stood at the end of the implementation period. And the purpose of this was two twin objectives. The first was to create the space for Parliament to, going forward, change EU law as and when it wanted to, which was one of the key messages, one of the key objectives of Brexit. And the second objective was to create as much legal certainty as possible for individuals and businesses in a way that was compatible with that first objective of restoring parliamentary control over policy. And so what we have is essentially a bedrock or a reservoir, choose your metaphor, of retained rules, norms, procedural rules, remedies, and so on from retained EU law, with certain things having been deleted and opted out of. And the point is that going forward, Parliament is in a position to change that body of law as it sees fit. Now, to come back to the question, which was, what's wrong with changing retained EU law? In principle, there is nothing wrong. Once the UK ceased to be a member of the European Union, the obligations that flowed from membership ceased, and the natural course for anyone, whether you voted for leave or remain, was to try to adapt the laws to suit our particular circumstances. The issue is how those changes should be made. Now, in my view, the changes to retained EU law should, where they can constitute some sort of major policy change or policy shift, should be made by Parliament in the form of primary legislation. Now, what this bill would do is it would allow ministers to make major changes to policy and other regulatory frameworks that we have come to rely upon through the use of secondary legislation, through the use of powers conferred upon ministers in the bill, subject to very little oversight by Parliament. And as a result, this bill would actually create a democratic deficit or exacerbate a democratic deficit, which would seem to be an unusual outcome if the purpose of this bill was to in some way realise the objective of Brexit, which was to restore parliamentary control.
Just before we get into the whole question of Henry VIII powers and Henry VIII powers on steroids argument, I just want to try out on you an example of the kind of legislation that is being changed specifically as opposed to under this bill. I just want to think of an example, Sam, of the kind of legislation that we've changed specifically by parliamentary debate, not under this bill, but as you perhaps may be arguing that we should be changing act by act, regulation by regulation. And what comes to mind are the EU regulations on genetically modified organisms that were implemented in this country as long ago as 2001. I mean, that's over 20 years ago. An awful lot of scientific and technological advancements have been made since. That a lot of scientists argue have made a bit of a nonsense of the very restrictive and heavy regulatory burden that the EU laws have imposed on GMOs. And we have proceeded with our own now Act of Parliament. I think it's called the Genetic Technology Precision Breeding Act, which recently received royal assent. This looks to me like a good step. It's a step away from outdated law that needed looking at. But obviously that was passed through Parliament with full parliamentary debate. Would you say that is the way that we should be going about the rest of retained EU law?
Yes, that is the correct way. And this isn't so much a debate about the substance of any particular policy area, but rather a question of how we as a policy, as a political system, should be making these major decisions about how areas of policy are decided and how they shall be regulated going forward. The government's recognition of this fact is reflected in the bill as it stands now. One of the few amendments that made it into the bill creates a carve-out from the sunset for financial services. There is currently a financial services bill going through Parliament which would address the retained EU law rules that concern those services. And so far, we're yet to see a convincing explanation for why the financial services sector, as important as it may be, deserves its own bill, its own process, and areas such as environmental regulation, labour rights, consumer protection, and so on. All of these areas of law that are very important to individuals and companies are not worthy of their own bill, their own specific parliamentary time.
As far as I can see from the figures, we've got 2,500 to nearly 3,000 bits of law, EU retained law, that need to be looked at. That's an awful lot. So why should the financial sectors be favoured in such a way? And also from what I can see from the figures, that something like over 500 pieces of EU law, retained legislation, case law, etc., are to do with agriculture, environment, animal welfare, and so on. So they're by far the largest sector. Can I just ask you to explain what this whole sunsetting clause means, in fact?
Yes. So there are actually several sunsets in the bill. So the first sunset to talk about, it can be found in Clause 1. The Clause 1 sunset would, at the end of this year, revoke or effectively delete from our statute book a category of law that the bill calls secondary retained EU law, or some version of that wording. The laws embraced by this category include regulations made by UK authorities to implement directives, an example being the working time regulations, which create a right to a maximum set of hours that you're working in the week and the right to holiday pay, but also directly applicable EU laws such as the GDPR, which has been retained as UK GDPR. So this first sunset would do away with these substantive pieces of legislation. The legislation that isn't affected by that sunset are pieces of primary legislation. So an example would be the Equality Act, which implemented various equality directives. The second sunset is a sunset of all of the retained cases, principles, liabilities, remedies, procedures, essentially a sweeping up provision in the Withdrawal Act under Section 4. Now, this seems like an amorphous and difficult to pin down provision, potentially for non-practitioners. But this is a really important provision of the Withdrawal Act because it saves rights as important as, say, the Article 157 right to equal pay between men and women for equal work or work of equal value. Now, this is a right that actually is more powerful than the equivalent in the Equality Act because it's less stringent in terms of comparators. It's a right that supermarket workers every day rely upon to secure higher wages for workers who work in stores who are disproportionately women and workers who work in distribution centers who are disproportionately men. And this right allows a comparison to be made of those, whereas that would be more difficult under the Equality Act. So this has a real practical significance for individuals in this country. The rights that have been swept up and kept in our law as a result of Section 4 have enduring importance. And what this clause would do, this sunset, it would do away with all of these rights. But unlike the first sunset, there is no provision for the sunset to be extended. So the sunset of legislation, such as GDPR and the working time regulations, can be extended up to 2026. By contrast, the sunset of directly effective rights under Section 4 of the Withdrawal Act cannot be extended. And this is a somewhat unexplained and difficult to justify omission because it means that there is a risk that certain rights will disappear at the end of this year if they haven't been identified. You mentioned earlier that there is this tally of retained EU law that keeps rising. The difficulty of identifying retained EU law, or at least provisions of it for the purpose of a dashboard, is that you can't quite pin it down as neatly as saying this set of regulations is retained EU law or this statute is retained EU law because of the nature of directives and the way they were given effect by harmonious interpretation. Many different areas of law can end up being retained EU law. You can have a regulation within a single regulation within a set of regulations that is retained EU law. You can have one section of an act that is retained EU law as a result of the way it's been interpreted.
Sam, we're talking about case law here. Now, how, in effect, is the sunsetting of EU case law going to work in the domestic courts, the lower courts, the appellate courts, the Supreme Courts? At what stage does a court have to decide, hang on, this is essentially EU case law, the case law of the European Court of Justice, and therefore I can depart from this? How is it going to work in effect when you're in court?
So the bill contains a new mechanism for working out how and when to depart from retained EU law. Now, the first place to start is the provision under the Withdrawal Act, the EWA, which provides that case law prior to the implementation period completion day, so the end of 2020, continues to be binding. And case law after that date is merely persuasive. Now, what this bill would do is it would change that rule and it would make essentially all legislation persuasive and it would allow courts to depart from the case law. For lower courts, the bill creates a new mechanism, somewhat like preliminary references, but without the trip to Luxembourg, where points of law can be sent up to higher courts where there is some precedent or some binding authority from that higher court, and the lower court considers there to be some issue that needs to be resolved, or there might be some case for departing from the law. It's difficult to say what the effect of this will be. The case that in some ways foreshadowed some of the provisions of this bill, Tunin and Warner, set the approach for whether to depart from retained EU law. And in that case, Lord Justice Arnold decided not to depart from the ECJ's case law on copyright, despite one of the parties making quite strong, forcefully put arguments about the inadequacies of the case law and academic critiques of the ECJ's approach. And basically the reason for that was the rule as it stands now is that appellate courts will only depart if the test for the Supreme Court departing from its own precedents is satisfied. And that is a very high standard. So in Horton and Sadler in 2006, Lord Bingham of Cornhill explained that The House has exercised its power to depart from its own precedent rarely and sparingly. It has never been thought enough to justify doing so that a later generation of law lords would have resolved an issue or formulated a principle differently from their predecessors. So this is a power that is rarely used by the Supreme Court. And there is one very good reason for this, which is that judgments are declaratory in nature. They don't act prospectively, usually. They are a statement of what the law has always been. And so if the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court alters the interpretation of a provision of retained EU law, that would have effect retroactively. And it would mean that parties might be placed in a situation where they had operated on the basis of an understanding of the law that wasn't actually the case. And this goes back to the entire reason and purpose of the Withdrawal Act, which was to create a situation where parties, individuals, companies could understand where they stood and Parliament could prospectively change the law if it considered it necessary to do so.
Whilst we're on the subject of legal certainty, this referral mechanism, this is just going to be a win-win for lawyers, is it not? We can create lots of satellite litigation and costs and delay and so on, referring points up to the higher courts. I can see it might be a rabbit hole rather like the one that we go down quite often with preliminary issue procedure.
I think it's great news for lawyers. I think it will generate a lot of work. And I attended one seminar workshop event where one of the lawyers was positively rubbing his hands with glee at the thought of litigating this mechanism. It's excellent for lawyers and not really useful for anyone else, which is sadly often the case with the legal profession. It will create a situation where settled legal problems, settled matters of interpretation, are suddenly open for dispute. An example of this that can be given is what concerns the working time regulations and the formula for calculating holiday pay. In Locke and British Gas, the broad interpretation of the European Court of Justice was applied so that commissions would count for the purpose of calculating holiday pay. This judgment wasn't particularly well received by the government, and it's probably fair to say that there might be parts of business or industry that might prefer a more restrictive reading of that particular rule. And so what this would potentially do is create the opportunity for parties to essentially try to roll the dice again and see if they can get a better result. Now, is this a bad thing for it to be done by law, or should it be done by legislation? I think it's probably better for it to be done by legislation for the reason that I gave just before, which was that this would have an unsettling and destabilizing effect. But the other reason as well, which links back to the government's own concerns about judicial activism and political lawyering, it seems to me like this bill actually creates a mechanism for essentially attempting to create policy change via litigation, and also puts the judiciary in a very difficult position where it will be called upon to make policy decisions, essentially, should this interpretation by the ECJ be abandoned because, let's say, technology has moved on. That might be the kind of argument that is made. And if the courts don't abandon the ECJ's judgment, it's not difficult to imagine how certain political actors or industrial parties or so on might decide to make issue of this and say that the courts aren't properly giving effect to Brexit. So I think this is a dangerous and tricky bit of the bill because it seems so technical on the face of it, and it doesn't get the blood flowing in terms of, apart from lawyers, for lawyers perhaps, but the idea of creating another procedural mechanism doesn't really excite most people. But it would in fact have some potentially significant consequences for how we make policy and also the political position of the judiciary.
I think this takes us on to the question of reverse supremacy, which is part of the bill. This is very much what we've been talking about, but what does that mean in principle?
Yeah, so this is one of the other curious provisions of the bill, a bit like the reference mechanism where we seem to be taking these European concepts and turning them into a sort of domestic Brexit concept. Essentially, what this would do is it would reverse the supremacy rule as it stands now. So just to summarize, the supremacy rule means that retained EU law takes priority over domestic law that was enacted before Brexit. So for an example, EU regulations that came into force in 2010 will take priority and be applied over a domestic statute that was enacted in 2012. This is a very orthodox application of EU law principles and shouldn't be of a surprise to anyone who is familiar with how our legal system has been working for the last few decades. Now, what this new rule would do is it would, and I'll just read out the text, any provision of retained direct EU legislation must so far as possible be read and given effect in a way which is compatible with all domestic enactments and is subject to all domestic enactments so far as it is incompatible with them. Now, the use of the word all is significant here. It would seem to suggest that, say, an EU regulation which came into force in 2000 would be supplanted by a domestic statute enacted in the 1940s. It would seem to suggest that no matter when in time UK legislation came into force, it would always defeat and always be applied over the EU law norm. Now, to make matters even more complicated, this relationship can be reversed by ministers exercising a power to create regulations, but they can only exercise this power in relation to specific provisions of domestic law and specific provisions of EU law. So they can't say all of the legislation in this particular policy area should retain EU-style supremacy. They would have to identify the provisions of retained EU law that they want to maintain a kind of a hierarchical position of superiority over domestic law.
If I understand you correctly, if a minister thinks that rather than a dusty piece of primary legislation from this country is not really up to the job, they can't assert the supremacy, they can't reverse back into the supremacy of a more modern EU piece of law. They have to identify individual provisions in both.
So the legislation uses the word specific and specified. So it does seem to be the case that in advance of the issue arising, the minister would have had to have identified this potential problem and have created regulations to govern the relationship. Otherwise, the default position is that the domestic law, no matter when it was enacted, no matter how it came into being, will always defeat the retained EU law provision.
Again, once this, assuming this bill passes into an act as it is or only lightly amended, how does all this work? Is it something like the Human Rights Act where courts can issue a declaration of incompatibility? So there's a sort of incompatibility finding between EU law and UK primary legislation.
So the bill creates a new power for the courts to make what are going to be called incompatibility orders. And what these orders would do is they would allow the courts to explain the effect of the incompatibility, delay the order coming into effect, make the order subject to conditions, and so on. So it's essentially a provision that would allow, where an incompatibility was identified, the court to explain how they are going to interpret the retained EU law subject to domestic law following that default reverse supremacy rule.
Sam, the real elephant in the room that we've been avoiding so far is the powers that this bill grants effectively the executive to barge through Parliament, if you like, changes to retained law via subordinate legislation. It's been described, as I referred to earlier, as Henry VIII powers on steroids. Indeed, we've had a whole podcast episode on LawPod UK on Henry VIII powers. Can you tell me what the problem specifically is in this bill?
The difficulty or the problem with the bill is that it creates a suite of powers that can be used to change the policy and the regulatory regimes of this country with minimal democratic oversight by Parliament. The most egregious of these powers can be found in what is now Clause 16. The numbering has changed somewhat. It was Clause 15, but now it's Clause 16. And this creates three powers: the power to revoke any secondary retained EU law without a replacement provision, the power to revoke any secondary retained EU law and replace it with an appropriate provision that achieves the same or similar objective. It's important to say that it's appropriate according to the person making the regulations. And the third one is the power to revoke any secondary retained EU law and make alternative provision for the revoked retained EU law. Now, these could pursue different objectives. So that's the difference between the second and third. And the other important thing to say about this is that these powers may only be used for a deregulatory purpose. And regulatory burdens are defined in Clause 1610 as financial cost, administrative inconvenience, obstacles to trade or innovation, obstacles to efficiency, the creation of sanctions, criminal sanctions, and so on. Now, what this does is it creates a deregulatory ratchet in the bill. It means that these powers can only be exercised in a way that would reduce the scope or the content of retained EU law rights. The other big problem with this is that these powers basically disregard the hierarchy of EU law. They treat EU legislation that is equivalent in importance and substantive content to an act of parliament to the most technical and specific piece of tertiary legislation. It treats GDPR, which is one of the two pillars of our data protection regime, alongside the Data Protection Act, as if it were the same as a commission decision deciding whether someone had a particular patent for a pharmaceutical product, or a commission decision when it was updating some scientific regulations. So this power, therefore, crushes all of EU law into one category that can be changed as if it were a mere, I say mere, but mere is probably the wrong word because UK statutory instruments sometimes do a lot and they probably shouldn't do as much as they do. But it would allow these very important parts of retained EU law to be changed as if they were UK statutory instruments. And I would just like to say, emphasize for a second that what this power would do is it would allow something as important as GDPR to effectively be completely rewritten by ministers with minimal oversight. And to put that in context, GDPR received far more scrutiny than most UK Acts of Parliament do. It took years to put into place. It took years of negotiation and wrangling between member states, between democratic actors, between civil society. It had lots of buy-in it was the product of a lot of negotiation, no matter what its faults are. And this would effectively reduce all of that work to a minister acting with the advice of their civil servants.
One of the most controversial pieces of EU legislation was the Fundamental Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms. And that's not the focus of this bill. Have we managed to turn off these charter rights? A lot of EU law references the charter in its preambles. So have we got rid of any worry about the Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms through this bill?
So the starting point, as I've been saying throughout this conversation, has to be the Withdrawal Act. The position under the Withdrawal Act is that the Charter is not part of domestic law. However, it performs this sort of giving and taking act a bit like what it does with supremacy, in that the Act says that the Charter may not be part of domestic law, but the general principles remain part of domestic law. And by the way, the general principles include all of the rights that were in the Charter. And then the government released a memo that set out how they believed all of the fundamental rights in the Charter were, in fact, in the general principles. The Withdrawal Act made one important change, which was to say that general principles couldn't be used as a freestanding basis for legal action. They weren't in themselves justiciable. They could be used as interpretative aids and as interpretative tools, but you couldn't necessarily rely upon them to bring an action alone. Now, what you mentioned just before was the reference to the Charter and fundamental rights and recitals to various pieces of EU legislation. Now, this links to another general principle or interpretative tool of EU law, which is the duty of harmonious interpretation. Now, this would also go under the bill. So both general principles and the duty of harmonious interpretation would go. And that means there would no longer be a requirement to interpret retained EU law in light of the general principles, including fundamental rights. Now, what would this mean in practice? It's difficult to say. And again, a bit like the reference mechanism, it's good news for lawyers, plenty to argue about.
good news for lawyers is good news for LawPod UKs.
Yes. It's important to say that primary legislation is excluded from the provisions of the sunsets, but they will nonetheless be affected by this bill because, of course, legislation such as the Equality Act, the Employment Rights Act, and so on, are interpreted in light of the directives that they implemented. So an example of where some of these difficulties may arise is the case of Walker and Innospec. Now, the starting point for this case, the Equality Act prohibits discrimination on grounds of protected characteristics, and this was in part a transposition of the Equal Treatment Framework Directive. And the Equality Act prohibits discriminatory rules or practices in relation to pensions subject to key exceptions. And one of those exceptions was paragraph 18 of Schedule 9, which permitted employers to restrict access to occupational benefits where the right to that benefit accrued before the 5th of December 2005, which was the date that same-sex couples became legally entitled to enter into civil partnerships. Now, in this case, Walker and Innospec, the Supreme Court disapplied this exception because it found that it was incompatible with EU anti-discrimination law. But this provision of the Equality Act remains on the statute book. If you go to the legislation.gov, whatever the link is, you can go to the Equality Act, you can look for this paragraph in Schedule 9, and you can still see it. It's there. The government explained in correspondence in 2020 that it planned to remove it, but it hasn't yet done so. And the key thing to understand about disapplication of law is that it isn't the same as quashing or strike down as we understand it from the US Supreme Court context. A disapplied provision of domestic law is still law and it's still in place. It can have effect for other purposes, but it just can't be applied where it would be incompatible with EU law. Now, what happens when this bill comes into force, when or if this bill comes into force? When the general principles fall away, the general principle of non-discrimination, when the principle of direct effect of directives falls away, when the principle of harmonious interpretation falls away, there's an open question. Does this provision of the Equality Act, Schedule paragraph 18 of Schedule 9, spring back into life? Now, this is one of the more obvious examples, and one would hope that the government will use the powers under this bill, this act, when it becomes an act, to restate or codify the effect of Walker and Innospec. This case is an example where there might be unintended consequences, where perhaps less visible examples of the application of the general principles and fundamental rights and non-discrimination provisions of EU law apply, and where the government maybe is not aware, or perhaps is aware, but doesn't have the resources or the time to address those concerns. And so changes might be made suddenly, unexpectedly, and there's no way really of knowing until someone brings a case before court.
So as the sun sets over this reservoir of EU law and disappears behind the cliff edge, etc., etc., we're going to find ourselves in a brave new world of what the bill calls post-EU assimilated EU law. Thank you very much, Sam, for coming and getting us through this quite difficult technical subject.
Thank you for having me, Rosalind.
Me again with a postscript to this episode. As I mentioned at the beginning, the government has tabled an amendment which will replace the current sunset in the bill with a list of the retained EU laws that it intends to revoke under the bill by the end of 2023. In the words of the business secretary, this provides certainty for business by making it clear which regulations will be removed from our statute book. Let's wait and see.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row.